part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. The weather today in central Illinois, it's mild but quite windy. And this morning we had thunder and lightning and some pretty heavy periods of rain. We're past the high for the day. That came this morning when the thermometer reached the mid-50s. By the time we head home this evening, it will be significantly cooler. And overnight tonight, we'll see lows in the 20s. Why do we see such swings in the weather? That's one of the questions we can take up this afternoon. The weather is our topic, and our guest is meteorologist Paul Douglas. He's the author of the new book, Restless Skies, the Ultimate Weather Book. Listeners, I invite your questions about the weather for our guest, meteorologist Paul Douglas. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Paul Douglas has been a broadcast weather reporter for more than 20 years. He's been chief meteorologist for Minneapolis television station WCCO since 1998. He is the founder of a company that offers forecasts over the internet, Digital Cyclone, and his 3D computer graphics company, Earthwatch Communications, was featured in Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park and Twister. A graduate of Penn State, he's married with two children. His book, Restless Skies, published by Barnes & Noble Books. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Paul, thanks for taking the time and visiting with us this afternoon.
Celeste, it's my pleasure to be on your show. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. The meteorologists that I have had the pleasure to know over the years were interested in the weather from a very young age, and this is also true for you. The weather bug bit you when you were 14. Tell us about that.
That's true, and I must say, before I say anything more, that I am an Ed Kieser fan. I've known Ed for many, many years, and you have one of the best in the business down there. At WILL. He's terrific. He knows his stuff. And if you work as a meteorologist in Illinois, you better know your stuff. People can find out fairly quickly during a major storm outbreak if you're just kind of reading the words on the teleprompter or if you know what you're talking about. But yes, the answer to your question, it was a hurricane named Agnes that traumatized me, got me fascinated in the weather when I was 14 back in Pennsylvania where I grew up. And I think a lot of people doing weather on radio and television were traumatized at one point as kids, whether it was lightning or tornadoes or floods. Something jolted them, and in the process of trying to learn more about what happened to them, they start researching, they start discovering, they sort of get sucked into the field. I think that's the way it works for a lot of meteorologists.
Yeah.
And we're sort of a nation of armchair meteorologists because we do see more severe weather than any other country on the planet, and increasingly it does seem to be becoming even more severe over time in our lifetime.
Yeah. Well, also thanks to meteorologists in the broadcast media, we're learning more and more, those of us who are not meteorologists, about the weather. We learn a lot from Ed Kieser, for example, just to mention Ed one more time here. One of the chapters in the book, thinking back to Agnes, is devoted to hurricanes. And hurricanes, you say, are something that has the power to have the power to keep you up at night. And you note at the outset of this chapter, they are tracked from space, and they're tracked almost minute by minute, but we're still at their mercy.
Yes, and this year has just been an amazing year, a sobering year for Floridians. Four hurricanes in one season. That has never happened since accurate records were first started back in 1851. The last time any state was hit four times was Texas in 1896, but Florida has never been hit that hard. And I think it's a wake-up call for people living on or near the coast. One in five homes in Florida was damaged or destroyed. And through all that, 59 fatalities, each one tragic, of course, but the death toll very easily, Celeste, could have been in the hundreds, even the thousands. And it still worries me a little bit that we have all the high technology, the NEXRAD Dopplers, the computer simulations, which do a pretty good job tracking where these storms are going. The one thing we don't do a good job at is predicting whether they will strengthen or weaken. And the concern is that you have a lot of people watching the Weather Channel, and the attitude is, hey, it's only a Category 1, it's a Category 2. If it gets really bad, you know, I'll take my family inland at the last moment. But for now, I'm going to just hang out with my house on the coast. And the problem is, if you go from a Cat 2 to a Cat 5 overnight, which has happened a few times, then you have a few million people trying to get inland at once, and it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, one of my concerns. People say, look, you couldn't have another Galveston. Back in 1900, one night in Galveston, over 10,000 Americans lost their lives. And I think there's this feeling that, well, technology will save us, and we have weather satellites, and there's no way you could get that scope disaster. But I can tell you that folks at the National Hurricane Center and at the highest levels of government at the Weather Service are very concerned that there could still be a hurricane disaster that claims thousands of lives. We're sort of a nation of sitting ducks, Celeste. 74% of Americans forecast to be on or near the beach by the year 2015. So everybody wants to retire on the water, at least a lot of people. But after the year we've had this year in Florida, I think a lot of people are reconsidering.
Yeah. Are there periods of years that are particularly active for hurricanes, and are we in that kind of period now?
We are, and that's a great question. And you can't link this to climate change directly and global warming. Some people are saying, well, here's another symptom of global warming. And not so fast. I mean, the hurricane cycle goes through roughly a 30, 40-year cycle. You'll have 10 to 20 years of relatively quiet weather. And we had that back in the 70s and 80s when much of Florida, much of the Gulf Coast and East Coast was being developed. But now it's sort of moment of truth time. We're back in a much more active cycle. It has less to do with average global temperature and more to do with the quantity of storms coming off the coast of Africa and conditions being ripe in the Atlantic with the salinity of the water. A lot of these factors sort of lining up now, and it looks like the next 10 to 20 years may be very busy and above normal in terms of frequency and intensity of hurricanes.
Yeah. You know, when I think of hurricanes, Paul, I think of wind. This was a real eye-opener for me in your book, Restless Skies. Since the 1970s, the biggest danger has come from inland flooding.
Yes.
So I have a couple of questions here. How significant is the danger from inland flooding? Why the change since the 70s? Does it have something to do with the development we've seen along coastal areas?
I think that's an excellent question, and it is a very eye-opening statistic because the question comes up, where can I go that's safe? For instance, with a lot of the hurricanes this year in Florida, people retreated to Orlando thinking, okay, I'm going to get away from the storm surge, I'm going to get away from the high tides, and we'll go to central Florida. And there, they didn't have to worry about the storm surge, but the flash flooding was severe, river flooding, people dying in their SUVs trying to get across streets. So it does bring up just a horrible logistics problem where you move hundreds of thousands or even millions of people. And you're right, we really have become a nation of sitting ducks in that more of us are in harm's way. We're allowed to rebuild. If a hurricane destroys your house, yes, chances are you paid a premium, a heck of a premium on your insurance, but you can probably rebuild on the same plot of land. And it's that way across much of America. I mean, we rebuild in the floodplain, and we say, okay, this is an acceptable level of risk. I know that maybe once every 10 years I'll get flooded out. but I still, it's beautiful, I'm going to live here. And so I think we really are at a point now where as a nation, some of these things are coming back to bite us. And as I tell people, in the book, the 10 most costly natural disasters have taken place in the last 10 years. Some of that, I think, is a function of the weather becoming a little more severe, but much of it is the fact that we are more vulnerable. More homes, subdivisions in what used to be farmland, you know, in the path of Tornado Alley, more people living in the floodplain, in spite of just the amazing floods we've had in recent years.
Yeah. Well, I asked the question about development because flooding can be sometimes more severe because we have all this pavement and the water has to go somewhere, and the runoff problem is...
That's very true. Flash flooding is on the increase. Rain cannot soak into the water the way it could 50, 100 years ago. And so we are seeing we've seen about a 20% increase in flash flooding since 1900. The water just is not falling as gently as it did for your grandparents or your great-grandparents. And a lot of theories why this is. Again, if you warm up the atmosphere, even by a degree or two, it doesn't sound like any big deal. But if you warm up the air, you increase the amount of moisture that that air can hold, and you increase the potential for flooding, for hail, for tornadic storms. One thing I found that was fascinating, is that corn may be contributing to more humidity in the summer. We're noticing that the dew point temperature, a measure of how much water is in the air, is often much higher in Illinois than it is in Texas or Louisiana, right next to the Gulf of Mexico. And many people were scratching their heads wondering, how could that be? That is the moisture source. But the theory, led by a researcher, in fact, at Northern Illinois University, David Changnon, his theory is that corn, new hybrids of corn, are releasing moisture into the air, especially at night. It's something called evapotranspiration. And the corn literally injects more moisture in the air. And so we're getting more of these sort of extreme humidity events where it's not getting any hotter in the summer, but a lot of people come up to me and just can't believe how much more humid it is now than it was even 20, 30, 50 years ago.
Hmm. Maybe we should be planting some of that corn out where they're drought. They see a lot of drought.
That's not a bad idea. Not a bad idea. And certainly if we warm up, even slightly, and I think all but the diehard skeptics have, most reasonable people look at the data and say something is going on. I mean, we do in fact seem to be warming up. It's a shame that this has become sort of a political football, Celeste, the global warming. Like somehow it's a litmus test of whether you're, you know, a moderate or a conservative or a liberal. I think all of us are environmentalists. We should be environmentalists, and all of us are stewards. And you look at what's happening in Alaska and along the northern tier states, and you scratch your head. Something is going on, and we can debate how much of it is man and how much of it is natural, but I think there's little doubt that something is happening, and we need to acknowledge that and come up with some smart American solutions to solve this problem.
Yeah. When you're asked about this issue, what do you point to as the strongest evidence for global warming?
Well, I mean, you look at what's happening with Arctic ice. You look at how this has affected Alaska. You know, the Alaskan, the Native Americans that live in Alaska, the Eskimo, throughout thousands of years have never had a word for robin. And just recently, in the past 20, 25 years, that word has sort of popped into their lexicon. And there's so many direct signs where you just look at melting permafrost, you look at millions of trees dying in Alaska, you look at the average temperature in Nome and the fact that they've tracked thunder showers for the first time ever in northern Alaska. It's fairly clear that something is going on, and Alaska is sort of the canary in the coal mine. And I'm not an alarmist. I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, go into a quandary here when talking about this. It's a big topic. It's a big subject. But look at the facts. We've increased carbon in the air by 31% in the last 250 years. That has never been registered, never been recorded throughout history, at least looking back hundreds of thousands of years, ice core samples. We've never seen that kind of a jump a spike in carbon. And so that is something that is new, that we are directly responsible for. There have been warm periods in the past, no doubt. In fact, it was even warmer around 800, 900 AD in Illinois. But that can be linked to wobbles in the Earth's orbit and the fact that the northern hemisphere was actually a little bit closer to the sun. This is the first time that, you know, waste products really can be linked to what's happening in the atmosphere. And I still think that there's a moral imperative that we acknowledge this, we look at the science. You know, the vast consensus of scientists, many of them with degrees far more advanced than anything I have, they've looked at this, Celeste, and they think that there's something going on and that we are having an effect.
Hmm. Meteorologist Paul Douglas, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's been a broadcast weather reporter for more than 20 years. He's chief meteorologist for Minneapolis television station WCCO, and he's the author of the new book Restless Skies, The Ultimate Weather Book. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name's Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions about the weather. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's go to the toll-free line. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us in Wellington. Line 4, go ahead.
Yes, when I read the story the other two or three years ago about you were talking about corn raising the humidity levels, I thought that was very interesting, but I think it should be pointed out it is not corn per se that is doing that. It is the thickness at which it's being planted that they are attributing it to.
Yes.
For instance, 40 years ago, almost all corn was planted on 38, 40-inch rows, and now if you plant 38, 40-inch rows, well, you're kind of considered to be behind the curve as a farmer. Most of it's planted on 15, 20, or 30-inch rows. So
yep.
It's much more dense, and therefore the canopy keeps the ground more damp, too.
That's very true. That's a very good point.
And Penn State must turn out a lot of good weathermen.
Well, that's nice of you. But, no, you bring up an excellent point in that, I mean, the techniques now that farmers employ are so much more sophisticated. They can get so much more yield out of every acre. And so it is, you're right, it's a function of being able to get more crops, more corn on a given acre. But I find it fascinating that we are nudging the weather, you know, inadvertently in certain directions. And this is one example. Another example, NASA did a study and showed that there were more showers and thunderstorms downwind of major cities, that San Antonio and Dallas were sparking more hail and more flooding over the suburbs to the east and northeast. And I find it fascinating, and I'm sure some good attorneys will get involved in a lawsuit at some point where the suburbs sue the city for sparking the flood. But that kind of thing, it sounds like science fiction, and it's turning out that we are nudging the weather inadvertently every day.
Is that the heat island effect?
Yes. Some of that, cities do tend to be hotter and drier, and also pollutants over the cities can act as nuclei and actually seed the clouds and increase the potential of shower and thunderstorm convection-type activity downwind. So it's a combination. It's the heat, but even more importantly, it is the condensation nuclei, the pollutants that a city emits that can seed clouds downwind.
Yeah. Well, the great heat wave in Chicago a few years ago, that was part of the problem. The city has spread out so far, and it got so warm, it got so heated up during the day, that at night there was no relief.
You're absolutely right, and the humidity levels were boggling. The dew points were up around 80 degrees, and increasingly, for whatever reason, we are seeing more of these extreme 80-degree dew point days, which is just, it's where you walk out of the house and you can't catch your breath. It's just oppressive. I was in Chicago working for Channel 2 when that happened, and I'll never forget. I mean, that entire two-day span, we didn't call it a heat wave. We called it a heat storm. It came on so suddenly and was so extreme, and the nighttime lows never went below 84 degrees for two nights. And you're right, people could not cool off at night. They couldn't recover. And many people, hundreds of people, were afraid to open up their doors, open up their windows. Mm-hmm. They were afraid to leave their homes or unable to leave their homes. And it was just a horrible tragedy Nearly 900 people lost their lives in the span of 2 or 3 days. And we like to think, well, you know, we're an advanced society and we take care of everybody. And I do worry that more of those kinds of events, not so much in Champaign, this is more an issue for St. Louis and Chicago and Detroit. But, you know, the next time the mercury does hit 110 and the dew point is 75, are we going to be ready? And will we be able to avert another disaster? I hope so.
Yeah. Although here in central Illinois, Paul, we have seen from time to time ozone alerts.
Yes. There's no question that that smog is on the increase and that, again, we pride ourselves on our technologies and we're able to do a lot of things, but there's no question that smog is insidious and more of us than ever are prone to smog, not just asthma sufferers, but people with heart ailments, respiratory ailments, infants, athletes, people that really want to train hard outside. There could easily be 20 to 30 days out of a typical summer where the air is unhealthy. And you think, well, Champaign, Urbana, you know, how bad can it be? I mean, we don't have that much heavy industry, but it's insidious in that it can float in from Chicago. It can drift up from St. Louis. And you don't have local problems. I mean, some of these local problems spread out. It can travel hundreds, even thousands of miles away.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line one. Good afternoon.
Hello. Is this just a general environmental degradation discussion, or is it global warming, or what is it? I just turned in for the discussion.
Okay, good question. We're talking about the weather today, and global warming is one of the weather topics that is out there at the moment,
okay.
And it's a hot topic, no pun intended there. Our guest is a meteorologist, Paul Douglas, and he's the author of a book, Restless Skies, the Ultimate Weather Book, and among the topics he addresses in the book, global warming and our weather patterns, are they changing?
Okay, well, let me just ask this question. Why, I was really nonplussed this past election cycle that the environment didn't seem to take as much of a predominant impact in the discussion as I thought it should. I think it ranked maybe as low as 10 in some informal poll in terms of the concern of American people. And secondly, my concern is why does President Bush and his EPA seemingly take this adamant approach that, you know, we're not going to do much in terms of joining the Kyoto Protocol or any other regulated forms of activity concerning greenhouse gases, most notably carbon dioxide, because we don't think it would hurt our economy, and we don't think the science is as clear as people think, even though I think the science is pretty overwhelming that there is a correlation between man-made activities creating enhancing CO2 and what we're experiencing in terms of these phenomena in terms of climate. Why does the president seemingly get a pass on this and his EPA?
No, you bring up a very good question, and I don't know. I wish I had a good answer, and my fear is that it may take a few weather catastrophes, a few climate catastrophes, before Americans, many of us have short-term memories.
But that could be too late.
I agree with you, and I think we can get out ahead of this, and we can actually get ahead of the Europeans. I mean, the Europeans have acknowledged that this is a real problem. And these are scientists that don't have an axe to grind. I mean, they're looking at the data and saying, look here, come on, it's pretty much black and white.
That's my opinion. I have more than a passing interest in this, and I'm just really amazed at the American people. And it would take, in my opinion, what I would call a Republican moment, as one of the law professors has written in this area, that the American people have to rise and say, you know, we want more in terms of preventative measures by our national government and our state governments. I don't seem to see that Republican moment at all on the radar screen.
I think it's a complex subject, in that you can't get instant gratification. It is such a big, it is a global topic. It will require international treaty, and if Kyoto was too harsh for America, then let's negotiate something that we can
live
with.
Well, I think Kyoto is just the first step, quite frankly.
Yeah.
If that's too harsh, then America is never going to get on the merry-go-round in terms of dealing with this problem. As I say, I'm just perplexed about why the seeming indifference at the governmental level, and of course that seems to percolate down to the American people.
I've heard it actually speculated, and I think there's some truth to this, that some folks at NASA, some of the NASA scientists, have actually been muzzled and not able to talk about this issue and this topic, and I find that troubling, that there could be anything resembling censorship at the highest levels. Again, the perception is, well, we don't have all the data. Let's wait 20 more years. The concern is, you know, the longer we wait, the harder it's going to be to mitigate this, to put any checks and balances in place to make this better. And I think there's something inherently immoral about dumping in the laps of our kids or our grandkids and saying, well, my grandkids will figure this out. I mean, we have the smarts, we have the technology, we have the people, we have the entrepreneurs, we have the small companies, you know, ethanol, wind power, solar, all of this can be a part of a sustainable energy initiative. And, I mean, President Bush, with one wave of his magic wand, could declare our energy independence. Within our lifetime, we are going to be totally energy independent. We are not going to be reliant on Saudi oil. And you know what? We're going to clean up. You know, there's enough coal. There's more coal energy in Illinois than there is BTU energy from oil in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And there are technologies to clean up that coal. I mean, we need to be looking at this stuff, and I don't pretend to have all the answers, but I just think that, you know, let the marketplace work. Let companies profit from new energy sources and energy solutions that make us less dependent on carbon-based fuels. It's already catching on. Anybody who's bought a hybrid vehicle, and there are now some great options, you know, is taking the right step. I mean, there are some things we can do. I traded in my SUV, and you know, just little things that all of us can do to try to make a difference. But I share your frustration, and I think that over time, this is going to become a bigger issue, and in the next election cycle, I think it may be one of the predominant issues.
Hmm. I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. I've got a couple of other listeners waiting to talk with us. Next, we're going to go to the toll-free line, a listener in Colfax, line 4. Go ahead.
Yes, we were fishing in right at the Kentucky-Tennessee border last spring in the middle of Kentucky Lake. We had been fishing all morning in a very heavy downpour. We were never alarmed because all the thunder we heard was quite distant. But after we had been out about 3 hours, we realized that when we cast our fishing lines, they were not coming down out of the air. Now, we were fishing with very light lures, but our fishing lines literally went up at about a 35 or 40 degree angle, and they wouldn't come down. We decided that we didn't know what that was, but we thought we shouldn't be on the water, and we came into the marina and had lunch. What was that?
That was the right call on your part. Go with your gut. There's something to be said about intuition, but there was a lot of static energy in the air, and, I mean, any time you can hear thunder, you are theoretically at risk. One thing I found that was fascinating in researching this book is more people are struck by lightning at the tail end of a storm. After the rain has stopped, they go back outside, they resume their golf game, or they head back out on the lake or the beach. And even with a thunderhead 10 miles away, they're struck dead. And this happens every year, and it's tragic that, you know, so many of these lightning-related injuries and fatalities can be avoided. But, yes, they're... basically, lightning is a giant spark, and you know, if the potential builds up to a certain level between charged particles, you know, you can get the actual lightning strike, and you may have been close to an actual strike nearby. So you did the right thing getting off the water. And also, some of those old husband's tales, those old wives' tales, turn out to be true. Fish biting best before a cold front?
Uh-huh.
True.
Oh, absolutely.
The fish go into a feeding frenzy.
The faster that barometer drops,
yep.
There's no question that that enhances fishing.
And this is one thing that I find somewhat reassuring. Yes, we have great technology, Doppler radar, supercomputers, but I find it fascinating that taking your cues from nature, you can still do a pretty good job reading the sky, and I'm sure many residents of Illinois who depend on the weather are truly armchair meteorologists. Some of the best weather forecasters on the planet don't have a degree, but they learn it the old-fashioned way, trial and error. And if you know what the clouds are doing and you know what the barometer's doing and which way the wind is blowing, you can make a pretty good 24-hour forecast. And again, in Illinois, it's not optional. You have to know your stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for confirming what we thought, but we really weren't sure. I've fished 45 years, and I'd never seen that, ever.
Yeah, that may have been a close call. I tell my kids that if you can hear thunder, you are in danger. Don't wait till you can see the lightning strike. By then, it may be too late. So I'm glad you got off the water, and you're around for a long time to come.
We hope so.
Best wishes.
Very much.
Thanks for the call. Happy fishing. Thunder, you know, pay attention when there's thunder out there. You know, when we hear thunder, though, it can sound like a very short, intense clap, or it can just rumble on. Are there things that we should be listening for in terms of, is the sound telling us something?
Well, certainly. If it's a long, low rumble, that often means cloud to cloud. If it's a sharp crack, where, you know, there isn't much rumble and it's just a bang, that usually implies cloud-to-ground lightning and possibly within a mile or two. And I tell people that they should really be going over the 30-30 rule with their kids, and it may save their lives. If you can count 30 seconds between hearing the thunder and seeing the flash, the storm is 6 miles away, it's time to get inside. If you can count 30 seconds. And the other side of that 30-30 rule is wait 30 minutes before going back outside after hearing the last clap of thunder. Because, again, just because the rain is over does not mean that the lightning threat is over. Every year, 1 to 200 Americans are killed by lightning. It claims more lives than hurricanes and tornadoes combined. It doesn't make the news as often, but it is every bit as dangerous, even more so, than a lot of other phenomenon, and people need to just really take it seriously. And one thing I found researching this book, Celeste, men are 4 times more likely to be struck than women. Now, I don't know if it means that they're 4 times more stubborn than women, or that it just means that they're more likely to be working and playing outside. I think it's the latter, but more men are outside working and playing than women, and thus more likely to be struck. But it is one of the more preventable things that you can do. First time you see the sky turning black and you hear that first rumble of thunder, it's time to duck indoors. If you're inside listening to WILL, you know, on your kitchen table, on your kitchen stool, you know, watching television, you're fine. In your car, you're fine. It's people that are outside on the ball field or, you know, on the tractor, they really are at risk. There's no question.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Pontiac on line 2. Hello. We have a listener there on line 2? No? Okay. Maybe they will call us back. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to talk with our guest meteorologist, Paul Douglas. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and 800-222-WILL. And we've got a listener coming in, so here now we'll get this caller lined up, and we'll talk with a listener before I ask Paula another question. We get launched into another topic. Here we go, line 1. Go ahead.
Hi. Excuse me. I have rather a silly question, but I was about to get into my hot tub, which is an enclosed area just outside the bedroom door, and I heard the lights flashed, and I said, no, I'm not going to get in the hot tub. Is that something that I have to be careful about?
Absolutely. People have been struck in their tubs during electrical storms. If lightning hits plumbing, you know, some of the pipes outside your dwelling, it can travel in through the plumbing, and every year a few people are electrocuted in their tubs. So I tell people to hold off on the shower, hold off on the bath, or the hot tub until after the storm has passed. The same way for telephones. If it is an old-fashioned, I hate to use that term because I'm dating myself, but a corded phone that's attached to the wall, you can be electrocuted if you're on the phone. If it's a cell phone or a mobile phone, a cordless phone, you're fine. But every year, you know, people are struck in the tub and talking on the telephone. Yes, good point.
A friendly place. Okay. Thank you. I'm glad I took my own counsel.
Yep, go with your gut. Your gut feeling is well-honed over the years, so I tell people to rely on their intuition more, and they'll probably be safer.
Okay, thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign, Line 2. Hello. Line 2?
Hello.
Hello, go ahead.
Yes. If we assume that, I hope I'm right. If I'm wrong, then please correct me, that light is faster than sound.
Yes.
Why are you saying that we should pay attention when we hear the sound? We shouldn't wait for the lightning. I would have thought that we'd see the lightning before the sound.
That's true. And I may have said it backwards, but yes, if you can count 30 seconds from seeing the flash, seeing the lightning, and then hearing the thunder, thunder travels about 1 mile in 5 seconds. So, you know, if you can count 30 seconds roughly between seeing the flash of lightning and hearing the bang of thunder, the storm is close enough to cause problems. But
So my assumption is correct, that the earliest signal that you should really watch out for
is the light
rather than the sound.
Yes. Sometimes it can be difficult, especially during the day, seeing the lightning. Many times our first cue is the thunder. At night, of course, it's much easier to see lightning, but sometimes during the day it can be very difficult to see the lightning.
How do you explain that? Why do you say sometimes?
Well, for instance, if the sun is out over your location and, you know, you're bathed in bright sunshine and there's a thunderstorm 7 or 8 miles away, you can see that the sky is black, the sky is dark, but many times you can't see the individual cloud-to-ground strikes because you are in bright sunlight, and it's just very difficult to see.
Oh, to discriminate between the light from the lightning and the regular light.
Exactly.
I see. Well, thank you so very much. I appreciate that.
You bet.
And,
no, that's a good question.
And I also want to express my appreciation of Celeste's program, not because I just like her name. Her name is beautiful. But just because she has some very interesting visitors.
Yes, I share your feelings about Celeste, very much so.
Thank you for the call and those kind words to our caller in Champaign and to you, Paul. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, Line 1. Hi.
Hi, thanks. Yes, I'm enjoying this, and I agree with enjoy your programs very much. Okay, I had a question. Are these facts, sorts of things that you're telling us, would they be found in your book?
They are. There's a chapter on climate change, about 25 pages out of the 250 pages is devoted to climate change. Barnes & Noble was pretty terrific. I mean, at first they fought me a little bit on the climate change, and they said, Paul, it's not very interesting, it's not very visual, and I countered that by saying, yes, but it's fairly important, and you can't have a serious book on weather without at least a chapter on climate change and what seems to be happening. But it's not all climate change. There's a chapter on folklore. Many of the things your grandmother told you about the weather turn out to be absolutely true. Chapter on technology, a chapter on hurricanes, a chapter on tornadoes.
Chapter on lightning?
Yes, there is a chapter on hail and high water and lightning, just focusing on thunderstorms and severe thunderstorms. So a lot of lightning stories, lightning facts, and stuff that every kid, every parent should know about lightning, absolutely.
Yes, well, which is really helpful to know. And the other things I know, I think I know from Ed Kieser warning us about lightning, which I appreciate very much. And, I'm hoping maybe your book will help to persuade my husband, who's a very intelligent person, but tends to like to, he loves storms, and he tends to want to be out in them, but I don't think it's a good idea. So, maybe we, and he's interested in weather, so maybe we could, I enjoy reading about the weather and and believe that he shouldn't be standing out in storms at the same time. Okay, this is great. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Thank you for the call.
Thanks for the call.
It's kind of interesting, Celeste. I've been tornado chasing in Oklahoma 3 times, and the scientists that do this aren't scared of the tornadoes. They can keep a safe distance between themselves and the tornadoes. What they are scared of is lightning and also sightseers hanging out of pickup trucks driving at 100 miles an hour with their video cams rolling. That's what they're scared of. They're not scared of the tornado, but it's mostly lightning. And I tell people in the summer, you just really have to take precautions. And every year about 1,000 Americans are injured by lightning. And many of these people have lifelong disabilities and are never quite the same after being struck. So, yes, they can be revived if you use CPR. You know, literally 8 out of 10 people struck by lightning can be brought back from the dead. They appear to be dead, and using CPR, they can be brought back. But, you know, why put yourself in that situation?
Yeah, it's pretty frightening.
It is.
Well, in that chapter, there are statistics on deaths, and in a period of less than 50 years, well, the state of Florida, more than 1,500 deaths, and Illinois, 360 deaths.
Yes, it's very sobering, and again, it is one of the more preventable forms of death.
Yeah.
But every year, you know, the United States is hit, and $4 to $5 billion in damage from lightning triggered every single year. So the statistics are amazing. Again, the odds of being struck and killed by lightning are about 1 in 30,000 over the course of your lifetime. And those odds were actually a little higher than I had hoped. You know, 1 in 30,000. The odds of being killed in an extreme heat wave, by comparison, 1 in 12,000. I don't mean this to sound morbid, but again, my goal in this book was to try to give people the information they need just to make smarter decisions.
Yeah.
And to also celebrate the weather and enjoy the weather and have fun with the weather. Every day in Illinois, we get a free show. Every day is different. No 2 days are identical meteorologically. And I find that wondrous. I find the fact that it's democratic. Everybody's affected. I find that wondrous and reassuring.
Well, one of the things that Ed likes to say is, no, don't talk about normal. Normal is abnormal. We talk about what's average. And, you know, the other thing that, you know, I've heard him say is, you know, if you don't like it today, just wait, you know.
That's true.
Hang in there. Hang in there.
That's very true. And I tell people, if you have 1 foot in boiling water and the other foot in ice water, do you feel normal? Do you feel average? Increasingly, that seems to be where we're going. But I'm grateful to Barnes & Noble for allowing me to write this book.
Yeah.
They really let me write the book I wanted to write, and it's more than a coffee table book. It's not an encyclopedia, but I'd say it's probably a little more of a reference book than it is a coffee table book. And hopefully there's some information that will appeal to the weather enthusiast of all ages. I think an 8-year-old would get something out of it, and hopefully an 88-year-old would too.
Yeah.
But it sure was fun putting together.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned a couple of times about, you know, old wives' tales or what your great-grandmother said about the weather. And observing, just being observant is very important. And we talked about that in terms of, you know, keeping up to date here on severe weather, when severe weather is, you know, pushing through the area, when there's a lightning in the area. And this was interesting. This is one of the facts out of the book. It was Ben Franklin who deduced that storms move. And another observant fellow, just an amateur weather watcher, Winthrop Redfield, realized that storms not only moved, they rotated.
That's exactly right. They were able to tell this based on the viewing of an eclipse Ben Franklin could see the eclipse, and one of his colleagues in Boston could not, and so that led them to believe that storms actually move, which was, for some reason, that was an epiphany. And by looking at the direction that trees in Connecticut fell during a storm, they were able to deduce that the winds were cyclonic around a hurricane. And so, for me, that's fascinating, just following the history of weather and weather discoveries. And we do have some amazing technologies in place now, Doppler radar, being able to see these spinning supercells that spawn tornadoes. You know, we can get the word out. And even though severe weather seems to be on the rise, fewer people than ever, Celeste, are dying from tornadoes and floods.
Right.
And that's, you know, technology, that's the Weather Service, that's meteorologists like Ed Kieser who can interpret the weather and know what to say and when to get on the air. And it does come down to interpretation. I mean, you can get 10 meteorologists looking at the same maps and they'll come up with 10 different 7-day forecasts. And I know that's frustrating, but, you know, much of it does come down to interpretation, history, which computer models do you believe?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is just experience. The weather in Champaign is different than the weather in St. Louis or Des Moines or Chicago. And so having a feel for your local area and how, you know, the local terrain or lack of terrain, local features can affect the weather, that can make a big difference, especially in the summer.
Right. Paul, we've used up the time. It went so quickly. Thank you very much for visiting with us this afternoon.
Celeste, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much. And again, the easiest way for your listeners might be just going to Barnes & Noble online. It's bn.com. And I sure appreciate your interest in weather. And please give my best to Ed Kieser. He's one of the best in the business.
Will do. Thank you so much, Paul.
Best wishes.
Paul Douglas has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's been in the weather business for more than 20 years. He's been chief meteorologist for Minneapolis television station WCCO since 1998. He's the author of Restless Skies, the Ultimate Weather Book. The book is published by Barnes & Noble Books. It's 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade, after a little up day yesterday in the bean and the corn pits, futures managed to close lower, and they took away all the gains from yesterday, and then some. Corn down 4 to 5 cents today. The beans were off 7 to 9 cents. Mike Zuzulo will be in this afternoon to talk with us instead of Wayne Nelson, who's away today. That during the closing market report comes up at six after this next hour. Now let's begin in the wheat pit where we always do. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade. The soft red winter wheat today had a high 292.5 in the December contract. The low at 285.75. Settlement price there down 0.75 cents at 287. The March futures at 304 high, low at 298, and a settlement price at 299 off 6.5 cents. May contract down 6 cents, 310.5 the high, the low at 305. The May wheat settled at 306. July futures, this the harvest month, 317.5 the high, the low at 312, settled 312.5. Rather 312.25, and they were down 6.25. September futures off 7 cents today, 323 the high, the low, and settlement price both at 319. That price for the September wheat for next year down 7 cents. December corn futures up, or rather down 4 cents for today, 198.25 the high, the low at 192. The settlement price at 193.75 for the December corn. Down 4. March futures off 5.75 today, 208.75 the high, the low at 02, settled 203.25 for the March, down 5.75. May contract 5.75 lower 2, had a high today of 216.25, a low at 210.25, and a settlement price at 10.75. Once again, the May corn settling $2.10.75. Down 5.75. July futures 223.75 the high, the low at 218, settled 218.5, down 5.25, and the September contract at 230.25 high, low at 226.25. Settlement price there 226.5, down 4.75. December contract 239 the high, the low at 235, settled at 236 even for Dease corn next year. The new crop settled down 3.25 for the day. December oats 168.75 the high, the low at 163.25, a settlement price at 160. 5, and they finished down 3 cents for the day. March contract at 158 high, low at 154 and a quarter, settlement price at 155 and a quarter, down 3. January soybeans off 7 and 3 quarters cents today with a high of 31 and a half, a low at 521 and a half, a 10 cent spread today. Settled closer to the low than the high by far at $5.22, just a half above the low for the day. And once again, the January beans off 7 and 3 quarters. March contract a 534 and a half high, low at 524, settled 525, down 9 cents. And the May futures 540 the high, the low at 530, settled a half above that at 530 and a half, down 9 and 1 quarter. July futures a 550 high, low at 537 and a half. July bean settled 538 and a quarter, down 9 and a half. And the August contract at 543 high, low at 541 and a half. Settlement price on that low at 541 and a half, and they were down 9 and a quarter for the day. December bean meal 159 the high, the low at 155.70, settled 156, down 240 for the day. And the January 159.90 the high, the low at 155.70, settled 156.10. They were off 320. Dease bean oil for the day 2022 the high, the low at 1990, settled 1992, off 26. And the January contract 2026 the high, low at 1985, settlement price at 1987, and they were down 31. One quick reminder as we go into the closing market report, a very special report from Dave Dickey today, that on the Supreme Court decision, which could come this week or should come this week, on the beef checkoff. You'll want to hear what Mr. Dickey has found out about how that checkoff decision by the Supreme Court and whether the checkoff is actually constitutional or not could have ramifications across all the checkoffs. That coming up during the closing market report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time today. Now, here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. January feeder cattle 101.65 the high, $100.85 the low, the settlement 101.02 and a half, that down 37 and a half. March 97.90 the high, 97.25 the low, 97.80 the settlement, that down 2.5. April 96.15 the high, 95.80 the low, 96.10 the settlement, that down a nickel. That finished up a nickel. December live cattle, 87.25 the high, 86.10 the low, 86.40 the settlement, that down 107.5. February, 87.90 the high, 86.75 the low, 87.25 the settlement, that down 65. December lean hog, 77 even the high, 75.75 the low, 75.95 the final price, that down 55. February, 73.95 the high, 72.25 the low, 72.37.5 the settlement, that down 95. April 70.95 the high, 69.87.5 the low, 70.42.5 the settlement, that down 25. May 70 even the high, 69.25 the low, 69.90 the settlement, that up 10. February bellies 97.90 the high, 95.50 the low, 97.50 the settlement, that up 65. The Dow is off 67 points, the NASDAQ down 21, the S&P 500 off 8.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young